34. It is in relation to possible objects in space. See footnote. Footnote. The reader, who may not so easily perceive the psychological sense of these expressions, taken here in their transcendental abstraction, and cannot guess why the latter attribute of the soul belongs to the category of existence, will find the expression sufficiently explained and justified in the sequel. I have, moreover, to apologize for the Latin terms which have been employed instead of their German synonyms, contrary to the rules of correct writing. But I judged it better to sacrifice elegance of language to perspicuity of exposition. From these elements originate all the conceptions of pure psychology, by combination alone, without the aid of any other principle. This substance, merely as an object of the internal sense, gives the conception of immateriality. As simple substance, that of incorruptibility, its identity as intellectual substance gives the conception of personality. All these three together, spirituality. Its relation to objects in space gives us the conception of connection, commercium, with bodies. Thus, it represents thinking substance as the principle of life in matter, that is, as a soul, anima, and as the ground of animality. And this, limited and determined by the conception of spirituality, gives us that of immortality. Now, to these conceptions relate four paralogisms of a transcendental psychology, which is falsely held to be a science of pure reason, touching the nature of our thinking being. We can, however, lay at the foundation of this science nothing but the simple and, in itself, perfectly contentless representation, I, which cannot even be called a conception, but merely a consciousness which accompanies all conceptions. By this I, or he, or it, who or which thinks, nothing more is represented than a transcendental subject of thought, equals X, which is cognized only by means of the thoughts that are its predicates, and of which, apart from these, we cannot form the least conception. Hence we are obliged to go round this representation in a perpetual circle, inasmuch as we must always employ it in order to frame any judgment respecting it. And this inconvenience we find it impossible to rid ourselves of, because consciousness in itself is not so much a representation distinguishing a particular object as a form of representation in general, insofar as it may be termed cognition. For in and by cognition alone do I think anything. It must, however, appear extraordinary at first sight that the condition under which I think, and which is consequently a property of my subject, should be held to be likewise valid for every existence which thinks, and that we can presume to base upon a seemingly empirical proposition a judgment which is apodictic and universal, to wit, that everything which thinks is constituted as the voice of my consciousness declares it to be, that is, as a self-conscious being. The cause of this belief is not to be found in the fact that we necessarily attribute to things a priori all the properties which constitute conditions under which alone we can cogitate them. Now I cannot obtain the least representation of a thinking being by means of external experience, but solely through self-consciousness. Such objects are consequently nothing more than the transference of this consciousness of mine to other things which can only thus be represented as thinking beings. The proposition, I think, is, in the present case, understood in a problematical sense, not in so far as it contains a perception of an existence, like the Cartesian cogito ergo sum. Footnote. I think, therefore I am. But in regard to its mere possibility, for the purpose of discovering what properties may be inferred from so simple a proposition and predicated of the subject of it. If at the foundation of our pure rational cognition of thinking beings there lay more than the mere cogito, if we could likewise call in aid observations on the play of our thoughts, and the thence derived natural laws of the thinking self, there would arise an empirical psychology which would be a kind of physiology of the internal sense, and might possibly be capable of explaining the phenomena of that sense. But it could never be available for discovering those properties which do not belong to possible experience, such as the quality of simplicity, nor could it make any apodictic enunciation of the nature of thinking beings. It would therefore not be a rational psychology. Now, as the proposition I think, in the problematical sense, contains the form of every judgment in general, and is the constant accompaniment of all the categories, it is manifest that conclusions are drawn from it only by a transcendental employment of the understanding. This use of the understanding excludes all empirical elements, and we cannot, as has been shown above, have any favourable conception beforehand of its procedure. We shall therefore follow with a critical eye this proposition through all the predicaments of pure psychology, but we shall, for brevity's sake, allow this examination to proceed in an uninterrupted connection. Before entering on this task, however, the following general remark may help to quicken our attention to this mode of argument. It is not merely through my thinking that I cognize an object, but only through my determining a given intuition in relation to the unity of consciousness in which all thinking consists. It follows that I cognize myself not through my being conscious of myself as thinking, but only when I am conscious of the intuition of myself as determined in relation to the function of thought. All the modi of self-consciousness in thought are hence not conceptions of objects, conceptions of the understanding, categories. They are mere logical functions which do not present to thought an object to be cognized, and cannot therefore present myself as an object. Not the consciousness of the determining, but only that of the determinable self, that is, of my internal intuition, in so far as the manifold contained in it can be connected conformably with the general condition of the unity of apperception in thought, is the object. 1. In all judgments, I am the determining subject of that relation which constitutes a judgment. But that the I which thinks must be considered as in thought always a subject, and as a thing which cannot be a predicate to thought, is an apodictic and identical proposition. But this proposition does not signify that I, as an object, am, for myself, a self-subsistent being or substance. This latter statement, an ambitious one, requires to be supported by data which are not to be discovered in thought, and are perhaps, in so far as I consider the thinking self merely as such, not to be discovered in the thinking self at all. 2. That the I, or ego of apperception, and consequently in all thought, is singular or simple, and cannot be resolved into a plurality of subjects, and therefore indicates a logically simple subject, this is self-evident from the very conception of an ego, and is consequently an analytical proposition. But this is not tantamount to declaring that the thinking ego is a simple substance, for this would be a synthetical proposition. The conception of substance always relates to intuitions, which with me cannot be other than sensuous, and which consequently lie completely out of the sphere of the understanding and its thought. But to this sphere belongs the affirmation that the ego is simple in thought. It would indeed be surprising if the conception of substance, which in other cases requires so much labour to distinguish from the other elements presented by intuition, so much trouble too to discover whether it can be simple, as in the case of the parts of matter, should be presented immediately to me as if by revelation in the poorest mental representation of all. 3. The proposition of the identity of myself amid all the manifold representations of which I am conscious is likewise a proposition lying in the conceptions themselves, and is consequently analytical. But this identity of the subject, of which I am conscious in all its representations, does not relate to or concern the intuition of the subject, by which it is given as an object. This proposition cannot therefore renounce the identity of the person, by which is understood the consciousness of the identity of its own substance as a thinking being in all change and variation of circumstances. To prove this, we should require not a mere analysis of the proposition, but synthetical judgments based upon a given intuition. 4. I distinguish my own existence as that of a thinking being from that of other things external to me, among which my body also is reckoned. This is also an analytical proposition, for other things are exactly those which I think as different or distinguished from myself. But whether this consciousness of myself is possible without things external to me, and whether therefore I can exist merely as a thinking being without being man, cannot be known or inferred from this proposition. Thus, we have gained nothing as regards the cognition of myself as object by the analysis of the consciousness of myself in thought. The logical exposition of thought in general is mistaken for the metaphysical determination of the object. Our critique would be an investigation utterly superfluous if there existed a possibility of proving a priori that all thinking beings are in themselves simple substances as such, therefore possesses the inseparable attribute of personality, and are conscious of their existence apart from and unconnected with matter. For we should thus have taken a step beyond the world of sense and have penetrated into the sphere of noumena. And in this case, the right could not be denied us of extending our knowledge in this sphere, of establishing ourselves, and under a favouring star, appropriating to ourselves possessions in it. For the proposition, every thinking being as such is simple substance, is an a priori synthetical proposition, because in the first place it goes beyond the conception which is the subject of it, and adds to the mere notion of a thinking being the mode of its existence. And in the second place, annexes a predicate, that of simplicity, to the latter conception, a predicate which I could not have discovered in the sphere of experience. It would follow that a priori synthetical propositions are possible and legitimate not only, as we have maintained, in relation to objects of possible experience and as principles of the possibility of this experience itself, but are applicable to things as things in themselves. An inference which makes an end of the whole of this critique, and obliges us to fall back on the old mode of metaphysical procedure. But, indeed, the danger is not so great if we look a little closer into the question. There lurks in the procedure of rational psychology a paralogism which is represented in the following syllogism. That which cannot be cogitated otherwise than as subject does not exist otherwise than as subject, and is therefore substance. A thinking being, considered merely as such, cannot be cogitated otherwise than as subject. Therefore, it exists also as such, that is, as substance. In the major, we speak of a being that can be cogitated generally and in every relation, consequently as it may be given in intuition. But in the minor, we speak of the same being only in so far as it regards itself as subject, relatively to thought and the unity of consciousness, but not in relation to intuition, by which it is presented as an object to thought. Thus, the conclusion is here arrived at by a sophisma figure dictionis. See footnote. Footnote. Thought is taken in the two premises in two totally different senses. In the major, it is considered as relating and applying to objects in general, consequently to objects of intuition also. In the minor, we understand it as relating merely to self-consciousness. In this sense, we do not cogitate an object, but merely the relation to the self-consciousness of the subject as the form of thought. In the former premise, we speak of things which cannot be cogitated otherwise than as subjects. In the second, we do not speak of things, but of thought, all objects being abstracted, in which the ego is always the subject of consciousness. Hence the conclusion cannot be, I cannot exist otherwise than as subject, but only, I can, in cogitating my existence, employ my ego only as the subject of the judgment. But this is an identical proposition, and throws no light on the mode of my existence. That this famous argument is a mere paralogism will be plain to anyone who will consider the general remark which precedes our exposition of the principles of the pure understanding and the section on noumena. For it was there proved that the conception of a thing which can exist per se, only as a subject and never as a predicate, possesses an objective reality. That is to say, we can never know whether there exists any object to correspond to the conception. Consequently, the conception is nothing more than a conception, and from it we derive no proper knowledge. If this conception is to indicate by the term substance an object that can be given, if it is to become a cognition, we must have at the foundation of the cognition a permanent intuition, as the indispensable condition of its objective reality. For through intuition alone can an object be given. But in internal intuition there is nothing permanent, for the ego is but the consciousness of my thought. If, then, we appeal merely to thought, we cannot discover the necessary condition of the application of the conception of substance, that is, of a subject existing per se, to the subject as a thinking being. And thus, the conception of the simple nature of substance, which is connected with the objective reality of this conception, is shown to be also valid, and to be, in fact, nothing more than the logical qualitative unity of self-consciousness in thought, while we remain perfectly ignorant whether the subject is composite or not. Refutation of the argument of Mendelssohn for the substantiality or permanence of the soul. This acute philosopher easily perceived the insufficiency of the common argument which attempts to prove that the soul, it being granted that it is a simple being, cannot perish by dissolution or decomposition. He saw it is not impossible for it to cease to be by extinction or disappearance. He endeavoured to prove in his Phaedo that the soul cannot be annihilated by showing that a simple being cannot cease to exist. Inasmuch as, he said, a simple existence cannot diminish nor gradually lose portions of its being, and thus be by degrees reduced to nothing, for it possesses no parts, and therefore no multiplicity. Between the moment in which it is and the moment in which it is not, no time can be discovered, which is impossible. But this philosopher did not consider that granting the soul to possess this simple nature, which contains no parts external to each other, and consequently no extensive quantity, we cannot refuse to it, any less than to any other being, intensive quantity, that is, a degree of reality in regard to all its faculties, nay, to all that constitutes its existence. But this degree of reality can become less and less through an infinite series of smaller degrees. It follows, therefore, that this supposed substance, this thing, the permanence of which is not assured in any other way, may, if not by decomposition, by gradual loss, remissio of its powers, consequently by elanguescence, if I may employ this expression, be changed into nothing. For consciousness itself has always a degree which may be lessened. See footnote. Consequently, the faculty of being conscious may be diminished, and so with all other faculties. The permanence of the soul, therefore, as an object of the internal sense, remains undemonstrated, nay, even undemonstrable. Its permanence in life is evident per se, inasmuch as the thinking being, as man, is to itself at the same time an object of the external senses. But this does not authorize the rational psychologist to affirm, from mere conceptions, its permanence beyond life. See footnote 2. Footnote. Clearness is not, as logicians maintain, the consciousness of a representation. For a certain degree of consciousness, which may not, however, be sufficient for recollection, is to be met with in many dim representations. For without any consciousness at all, we should not be able to recognize any difference in the obscure representations we connect, as we really can do with many conceptions, such as those of right and justice, and those of the musician who strikes at once several notes in improvising a piece of music. But a representation is clear in which our consciousness is sufficient for the consciousness of the difference of this representation from others. If we are only conscious that there is a difference, but are not conscious of the difference, that is, what the difference is, the representation must be termed obscure. There is, consequently, an infinite series of degrees of consciousness down to its entire disappearance. Footnote 2. There are some who think they have done enough to establish a new possibility of the mode of existence of souls when they have shown that there is no contradiction in their hypotheses on this subject. Such are those who affirm the possibility of thought, of which they have no other knowledge than what they derive from its use in connecting empirical intuitions presented in this our human life, after this life has ceased. But it is very easy to embarrass them by the introduction of counter-possibilities, which rest upon quite as good a foundation. Such, for example, is the possibility of the division of a simple substance into several substances, and conversely of the coalition of several into one simple substance. For, although divisibility presupposes composition, it does not necessarily require a composition of substances, but only of the degrees, of the several faculties, of one and the same substance. Now we can cogitate all the powers and faculties of the soul, even that of consciousness, has diminished by one half, the substance still remaining. In the same way, we can represent to ourselves without contradiction this obliterated half as preserved not in the soul but without it, and we can believe that, as in this case, everything that is real in the soul and has a degree, consequently its entire existence, has been halved, a particular substance would arise out of the soul. For the multiplicity which has been divided formerly existed, but not as a multiplicity of substances, but of every reality as the quantum of existence in it. And the unity of substance was merely a mode of existence, which by this division alone has been transformed into a plurality of substance. In the same manner, several simple substances might coalesce into one, without anything being lost except the plurality of subsistence, inasmuch as the one substance would contain the degree of reality of all the former substances. Perhaps, indeed, the simple substances, which appear under the form of matter, might, not indeed by a mechanical or chemical influence upon each other, but by an unknown influence, of which the former would be but the phenomenal appearance, by means of such a dynamical division of the parent souls as intensive quantities, produce other souls, while the former repaired the loss thus sustained with new matter of the same sort. I am far from allowing any value to such chimeras, and the principles of our analytic have clearly proved that no other than an empirical use of the categories, that of substance, for example, is possible. But if the rationalist is bold enough to construct on the mere authority of the faculty of thought, without any intuition whereby an object is given, a self-subsistent being, merely because the unity of apperception in thought cannot allow him to believe in a composite being, instead of declaring, as he ought to do, that he is unable to explain the possibility of a thinking nature, what ought to hinder the materialist, with as complete an independence of experience, to employ the principle of the rationalist in a directly opposite manner, still preserving the formal unity required by his opponent? If now we take the above propositions, as they must be accepted as valid for all thinking beings in the system of rational psychology, in synthetical connection, and proceed from the category of relation with the proposition, all thinking beings are as such substances, backwards through the series till the circle is completed, we come at last to their existence, of which, in this system of rational psychology, substances are held to be conscious, independently of external things. Nay, it is asserted that, in relation to the permanence which is a necessary characteristic of substance, they can of themselves determine external things. It follows that idealism, at least problematical idealism, is perfectly unavoidable in this rationalistic system. And if the existence of outward things is not held to be requisite to the determination of the existence of a substance in time, the existence of these outward things at all is a gratuitous assumption which remains without the possibility of a proof. But if we proceed analytically, the I think as a proposition containing in itself an existence as given, consequently modality being the principle, and dissect this proposition in order to ascertain its content and discover whether and how this ego determines its existence in time and space without the aid of anything external, the propositions of rationalistic psychology would not begin with the conception of a thinking being, but with a reality, and the properties of a thinking being in general would be deduced from the mode in which this reality is cogitated, after everything empirical had been abstracted, as is shown in the following table. 1. I think. 2. As subject. 3. As simple subject. 4. As identical subject in every state of my thought. Now, inasmuch as it is not determined in this second proposition whether I can exist and be cogitated only as subject, and not also as a predicate of another being, the conception of a subject is here taken in a merely logical sense. And it remains undetermined whether substance is to be cogitated under the conception or not. But in the third proposition, the absolute unity of apperception, the simple ego in the representation to which all connection and separation which constitute thought relate, is of itself important, even although it presents us with no information about the constitution or subsistence of the subject. Apperception is something real, and the simplicity of its nature is given in the very fact of its possibility. Now, in space, there is nothing real that is at the same time simple. For points, which are the only simple things in space, are merely limits but not constituent parts of space. From this follows the impossibility of a definition on the basis of materialism of the constitution of my ego as a merely thinking subject. But because my existence is considered in the first proposition as given, for it does not mean every thinking being exists, for this would be predicating of them absolute necessity, but only I exist thinking, the proposition is quite empirical and contains the determinability of my existence merely in relation to my representations in time. But as I require for this purpose something that is permanent, such as is not given in internal intuition, the mode of my existence, whether as substance or as accident, cannot be determined by means of this simple self-consciousness. Thus, if materialism is inadequate to explain the mode in which I exist, spiritualism is likewise as insufficient, and the conclusion is that we are utterly unable to attain to any knowledge of the constitution of the soul in so far as relates to the possibility of its existence apart from external objects. And indeed, how should it be possible, merely by the aid of the unity of consciousness, which we cognize only for the reason that it is indispensable to the possibility of experience, to pass the bounds of experience, our existence in this life, and to extend our cognition to the nature of all thinking beings by means of the empirical, but in relation to every sort of intuition, perfectly undetermined proposition, I think. There does not then exist any rational psychology as a doctrine furnishing any addition to our knowledge of ourselves. It is nothing more than a discipline which sets impassable limits to speculative reason in this region of thought to prevent it, on the one hand, from throwing itself into the arms of a soulless materialism, and, on the other, from losing itself in the mazes of a baseless spiritualism. It teaches us to consider this refusal of our reason to give any satisfactory answer to questions which reach beyond the limits of this our human life as a hint to abandon fruitless speculation, and to direct to a practical use our knowledge of ourselves, which, although applicable only to objects of experience, receives its principles from a higher source and regulates its procedure as if our destiny reached far beyond the boundaries of experience and life. From all this, it is evident that rational psychology has its origin in a mere misunderstanding. The unity of consciousness, which lies at the basis of the categories, is considered to be an intuition of the subject as an object, and the category of substances is applied to the intuition. But this unity is nothing more than the unity in thought by which no object is given, to which, therefore, the category of substance, which always presupposes a given intuition, cannot be applied. Consequently, the subject cannot be cognized. The subject of the categories cannot, therefore, for the very reason that it cogitates these, frame any conception of itself as an object of the categories. For, to cogitate these, it must lay at the foundation of its own pure self-consciousness, the very thing that it wishes to explain and describe. In like manner, the subject in which the representation of time has its basis cannot determine, for this very reason, its own existence in time. Now, if the latter is impossible, the former, as an attempt to determine itself by means of the categories as a thinking being in general, is no less so. See footnote. Footnote. The I think is, as has been already stated, an empirical proposition, and contains the expression, I exist. But I cannot say, everything which thinks exists, for in this case the property of thought would constitute all beings possessing it, necessary beings. Hence my existence cannot be considered as an inference from the proposition, I think, as Descartes maintained, because in this case the major premise, everything which thinks exists, must proceed, but the two propositions are identical. The proposition, I think, expresses an undetermined empirical tuition, that is, perception, proving consequently that sensation, which must belong to sensibility, lies at the foundation of this proposition. but it precedes experience, whose province it is to determine an object of perception by means of the categories in relation to time, and existence in the proposition is not a category, as it does not apply to an undetermined given object, but only one of which we have a conception, and about which we wish to know whether it does or does not exist, out of and apart from this conception. An undetermined perception signifies here merely something real that has been given, only, however, to thought in general, but not as a phenomenon nor as a thing in itself, noumenon, but only as something that really exists, and is designated as such in the proposition I think. For it must be remarked that, when I call the proposition I think an empirical proposition, I do not thereby mean that the ego in the proposition is an empirical representation. On the contrary, it is purely intellectual, because it belongs to thought in general. But without some empirical representation which presents to the mind material for thought, the mental act, I think, would not take place, and the empirical is only the condition of the application or employment of the pure intellectual faculty. Thus, then, appears the vanity of the hope of establishing a cognition which is to extend its rule beyond the limits of experience, a cognition which is one of the highest interests of humanity, and thus is proved the futility of the attempt of speculative philosophy in this region of thought. But, in this interest of thought, the severity of criticism has rendered to reason a not unimportant service by the demonstration of the impossibility of making any dogmatical affirmation concerning an object of experience beyond the boundaries of experience. She has thus fortified reason against all affirmations of the contrary. Now this can be accomplished in only two ways. Either our proposition must be proved apodictically, or, if this is unsuccessful, the sources of this inability must be sought for, and if these are discovered to exist in the natural and necessary limitation of our reason, our opponents must submit to the same law of renunciation, and refrain from advancing claims to dogmatic assertion. But the right, say rather the necessity to admit a future life upon principles of the practical conjoined with the speculative use of reason, has lost nothing by this renunciation. For the merely speculative proof has never had any influence upon the common reason of men. It stands upon the point of a hair, so that even the schools have been able to preserve it from falling only by incessantly discussing it and spinning it like a top. And even in their eyes it has never been able to present any safe foundation for the erection of a theory. The proofs which have been current among men preserve their value undiminished, nay, rather gain in clearness and unsophisticated power by the rejection of the dogmatical assumptions of speculative reason. For reason is thus confined within her own peculiar province, the arrangement of ends or aims which is at the same time the arrangement of nature. And as a practical faculty, without limiting itself to the latter, it is justified in extending the former, and with it our own existence, beyond the boundaries of experience and life. If we turn our attention to the analogy of the nature of living beings in this world, in the consideration of which reason is obliged to accept as a principle that no organ, no faculty, no appetite is useless, and that nothing is superfluous, nothing disproportionate to its use, nothing unsuited to its end, but that, on the contrary, everything is perfectly conformed to its destination in life, we shall find that man, who alone is the final end and aim of this order, is still the only animal that seems to be accepted from it. For his natural gifts, not merely as regards the talents and motives that may incite him to employ them, but especially the moral law in him, stretch so far beyond all mere earthly utility and advantage that he feels himself bound to prize the mere consciousness of probity apart from all advantageous consequences, even the shadowy gift of posthumous fame, above everything, and he is conscious of an inward call to constitute himself by his conduct in the world, without regard to mere sublunary interests, the citizen of a better. This mighty, irresistible proof, accompanied by an ever-increasing knowledge of the conformability to a purpose in everything we see around us, by the conviction of the boundless immensity of creation, by the consciousness of a certain illimitableness in the possible extension of our knowledge, and by a desire commensurate therewith, remains to humanity even after the theoretical cognition of ourselves has failed to establish the necessity of an existence after death. Conclusion of the solution of the psychological paralogism. The dialectical illusion in rational psychology arises from our confounding an idea of reason, of a pure intelligence, with the conception, in every respect undetermined, of a thinking being in general. I cogitate myself in behalf of a possible experience, at the same time making abstraction of all actual experience, and infer therefrom that I can be conscious of myself apart from experience and its empirical conditions. I consequently confound the possible abstraction of my empirically determined existence with the supposed consciousness of a possible separate existence of my thinking self, and I believe that I cognize what is substantial in myself as a transcendental subject when I have nothing more in thought than the unity of consciousness, which lies at the basis of all determination of cognition. The task of explaining the community of the soul with the body does not properly belong to the psychology of which we are here speaking, because it proposes to prove the personality of the soul apart from this communion after death, and is therefore transcendent in the proper sense of the word, although occupying itself with an object of experience, only in so far, however, as it ceases to be an object of experience. But a sufficient answer may be found to the question in our system. The difficulty which lies in the execution of this task consists, as is well known, in the presupposed heterogeneity of the object of the internal sense, the soul, and the objects of the external senses. Inasmuch as the formal condition of the intuition of the one is time, and of that of the other space also. But if we consider that both kinds of objects do not differ internally, but only in so far as the one appears externally to the other, consequently, that what lies on the basis of phenomenon as a thing in itself may not be heterogeneous, this difficulty disappears. There then remains no other difficulty than is to be found in the question, how a community of substances is possible, a question which lies out of the region of psychology, and which the reader, after what in our analytic has been said of primitive forces and faculties, will easily judge to be also beyond the region of human cognition. General remark. On the transition from rational psychology to cosmology. The proposition I think, or I exist thinking, is an empirical proposition. But such a proposition must be based on empirical intuition, and the object cogitated as a phenomenon. And thus our theory appears to maintain that the soul, even in thought, is merely a phenomenon. And in this way our consciousness itself, in fact, abuts upon nothing. Thought, per se, is merely the purely spontaneous logical function which operates to connect the manifold of a possible intuition, and it does not represent the subject of consciousness as a phenomenon, for this reason alone that it pays no attention to the question whether the mode of intuiting it is sensuous or intellectual. I therefore do not represent myself in thought either as I am or as I appear to myself. I merely cogitate myself as an object in general, of the mode of intuiting which I make abstraction. When I represent myself as the subject of thought, or as the ground of thought, these modes of representation are not related to the categories of substance or of cause, for these are functions of thought applicable only to our sensuous intuition. The application of these categories to the ego would, however, be necessary if I wished to make myself an object of knowledge. But I wish to be conscious of myself only as thinking. In what mode myself is given in intuition, I do not consider, and it may be that I who think am a phenomenon, although not in so far as I am a thinking being. But in the consciousness of myself in mere thought I am a being, though this consciousness does not present to me any property of this being as material for thought. But the proposition I think, in so far as it declares I exist thinking, is not the mere representation of a logical function. It determines the subject, which is in this case an object also, in relation to existence. And it cannot be given without the aid of the internal sense, whose intuition presents to us an object not as a thing in itself, but always as a phenomenon. In this proposition there is therefore something more to be found than the mere spontaneity of thought. There is also the receptivity of intuition, that is, my thought of myself applied to the empirical intuition of myself. Now, in this intuition, the thinking self must seek the conditions of the employment of its logical functions as categories of substance, cause, and so forth, not merely for the purpose of distinguishing itself as an object in itself by means of the representation I, but also for the purpose of determining the mode of its existence, that is, of cognizing itself as noumenon. But this is impossible, for the internal empirical intuition is sensuous and presents us with nothing but phenomenal data, which do not assist the object of pure consciousness in its attempts to cognize itself as a separate existence, but are useful only as contributions to experience. But let it be granted that we could discover, not in experience, but in certain firmly established a priori laws of the use of pure reason, laws relating to our existence, authority to consider ourselves as legislating a priori in relation to our own existence and as determining this existence. We should, on this supposition, find ourselves possessed of a spontaneity by which our actual existence would be determinable without the aid of the conditions of empirical intuition. We should also become aware that in the consciousness of our existence there was an a priori content which would serve to determine our own existence, an existence only sensuously determinable, relatively, however, to a certain internal faculty in relation to an intelligible world. But this would not give the least help to the attempts of rational psychology. For this wonderful faculty, which the consciousness of the moral law in me reveals, would present me with a principle of the determination of my own existence which is purely intellectual. But by what predicates? By none other than those which are given in sensuous intuition. Thus, I should find myself in the same position in rational psychology which I formerly occupied. That is to say, I should find myself still in need of sensuous intuitions in order to give significance to my conceptions of substance and cause, by means of which alone I can possess a knowledge of myself. But these intuitions can never raise me above the sphere of experience. I should be justified, however, in applying these conceptions in regard to their practical use, which is always directed to objects of experience, in conformity with their analogical significance when employed theoretically, to freedom and its subject. At the same time, I should understand by them merely the logical functions of subject and predicate, of principle and consequence, in conformity with which all actions are so determined that they are capable of being explained along with the laws of nature, conformably to the categories of substance and cause, although they originate from a very different principle. We have made these observations for the purpose of guarding against misunderstanding, to which the doctrine of our intuition of self as a phenomenon is exposed. We shall have occasion to perceive their utility in the sequel. Chapter 2. The Antinomy of Pure Reason. We showed in the introduction to this part of our work that all transcendental illusion of pure reason arose from dialectical arguments, the schema of which logic gives us in its three formal species of syllogisms, just as the categories find their logical schema in the four functions of all judgments. The first kind of these sophistical arguments related to the unconditioned unity of the subjective conditions of all representations in general, of the subject or soul, in correspondence with the categorical syllogisms, the major of which, as the principle, enounces the relation of a predicate to a subject. The second kind of dialectical argument will therefore be concerned, following the analogy with hypothetical syllogisms, with the unconditioned unity of the objective conditions in the phenomenon. And in this way, the theme of the third kind to be treated of in the following chapter will be the unconditioned unity of the objective conditions of the possibility of objects in general. But it is worthy of remark that the transcendental paralogism produced in the mind only a one-sided illusion in regard to the idea of the subject of our thought, and the conceptions of reason gave no ground to maintain the contrary proposition. The advantage is completely on the side of pneumatism, although this theory itself passes into naught in the crucible of pure reason. Very different is the case when we apply reason to the objective synthesis of phenomena. Here, certainly, reason establishes with much plausibility its principle of unconditioned unity, but it very soon falls into such contradictions that it is compelled, in relation to cosmology, to renounce its pretensions. For here a new phenomenon of human reason meets us, a perfectly natural antithetic, which does not require to be sought for by subtle sophistry, but into which reason of itself unavoidably falls. It is thereby preserved, to be sure, from the slumber of a fancied conviction, which a merely one-sided illusion produces, but it is at the same time compelled, either on the one hand to abandon itself to a despairing scepticism, or on the other to assume a dogmatical confidence and obstinate persistence in certain assertions, without granting a fair hearing to the other side of the question. Either is the death of a sound philosophy, although the former might perhaps deserve the title of the euthanasia of pure reason. Before entering this region of discord and confusion, which the conflict of the laws of pure reason, antinomy, produces, we shall present the reader with some considerations in explanation and justification of the method we intend to follow in our treatment of this subject. I term all transcendental ideas, insofar as they relate to the absolute totality in the synthesis of phenomena, cosmical conceptions, partly on account of this unconditioned totality on which the conception of the world whole is based, a conception which is itself an idea, partly because they relate solely to the synthesis of phenomena, the empirical synthesis. While, on the other hand, the absolute totality in the synthesis of the conditions of all possible things gives rise to an ideal of pure reason, which is quite distinct from the cosmical conception, although it stands in relation with it. Hence, as the paralogisms of pure reason laid the foundation for a dialectical psychology, the antinomy of pure reason will present us with the transcendental principles of pretended pure rational cosmology. Not, however, to declare it valid and to appropriate it, but, as the very term of a conflict of reason sufficiently indicates, to present it as an idea which cannot be reconciled with phenomena and experience. Section 1. System of Cosmological Ideas. That we may be able to enumerate with systematic precision these ideas according to a principle, we must remark in the first place that it is from the understanding alone that pure and transcendental conceptions take their origin, that the reason does not properly give birth to any conception, but only frees the conception of the understanding from the unavoidable limitation of a possible experience, and thus endeavours to raise it above the empirical, though it must still be in connection with it. This happens from the fact that for a given conditioned, reason demands absolute totality on the side of the conditions, to which the understanding submits all phenomena, and thus makes of the category a transcendental idea. This it does that it may be able to give absolute completeness to the empirical synthesis by continuing it to the unconditioned, which is not to be found in experience, but only in the idea. Reason requires this according to the principle, if the conditioned is given, the whole of the conditions, and consequently the absolutely unconditioned, is also given, whereby alone the former was possible. First, then, the transcendental ideas are properly nothing but categories elevated to the unconditioned, and they may be arranged in a table according to the titles of the latter. But, secondly, all the categories are not available for this purpose, but only those in which the synthesis constitutes a series of conditions subordinated to, not coordinated with each other. Absolute totality is required of reason only in so far as concerns the ascending series of the conditions of a conditioned, not, consequently, when the question relates to the descending series of consequences, or to the aggregate of the coordinated conditions of these consequences. For, in relation to a given conditioned, conditions are presupposed and considered to be given along with it. On the other hand, as the consequences do not render possible their conditions, but rather presuppose them, in the consideration of the procession of consequences, or in the descent from the given condition to the conditioned, we may be quite unconcerned whether the series ceases or not, and their totality is not a necessary demand of reason. Thus we cogitate, and necessarily, A given time completely elapsed up to a given moment, although that time is not determinable by us. But as regards time future, which is not the condition of arriving at the present in order to conceive it, it is quite indifferent whether we consider future time as ceasing at some point or as prolonging itself to infinity. Take, for example, the series MNO, in which N is given as conditioned in relation to M, but at the same time as the condition of O, and let the series proceed upwards from the conditioned M to M, L, K, I, etc., and also downwards from the condition N to the condition O, P, Q, R, etc. I must presuppose the former series to be able to consider N as given, and N is, according to reason, the totality of conditions, possible only by means of that series. But its possibility does not rest on the following series, O, P, Q, R, which, for this reason, cannot be regarded as given, but only as capable of being given, dabilis. I shall term the synthesis of the series on the side of the conditions, from that nearest to the given phenomena up to the more remote, regressive. That which proceeds on the side of the conditioned, from the immediate consequence to the more remote, I shall call the progressive synthesis. The former proceeds in antecedentia, the latter in consequentia. The cosmological ideas are therefore occupied with the totality of the regressive synthesis, and proceed in antecedentia, not in consequentia. When the latter takes place, it is an arbitrary and not a necessary problem of pure reason. For we require for the complete understanding of what is given in a phenomenon not the consequences which succeed, but the grounds or principles which precede. In order to construct the table of ideas in correspondence with the table of categories, we take first the two primitive quanta of all our intuition, time and space. Time is in itself a series, and the formal condition of all series, and hence, in relation to a given present, we must distinguish a priori in it the antecedentia as conditions time past, from consequentia, time future. Consequently, the transcendental idea of the absolute totality of the series of the conditions of a given conditioned relates merely to all past time. According to the idea of reason, the whole past time, as the condition of the given moment, is necessarily cogitated as given. But as regards space, there exists in it no distinction between progressus and regressus, for it is an aggregate and not a series, its parts existing together at the same time. I can consider a given point of time in relation to past time only as conditioned, because this given moment comes into existence only through the past time, or rather through the passing of the preceding time. But as the parts of space are not subordinated, but coordinated to each other, one part cannot be the condition of the possibility of the other, and space is not in itself, like time, a series. But the synthesis of the manifold parts of space, the syntheses whereby we apprehend space, is nevertheless successive. It takes place, therefore, in time and contains a series. And as in this series of aggregated spaces, for example, the feet in a rood, beginning with a given portion of space, those which continue to be annexed form the condition of the limits of the former, the measurement of a space must also be regarded as a synthesis of the series of the conditions of a given conditioned. It differs, however, in this respect from that of time, that the side of the conditioned is not in itself distinguishable from the side of the condition, and consequently regressus and progressus in space seem to be identical. But inasmuch as one part of space is not given, but only limited by and through another, we must also consider every limited space as conditioned, insofar as it presupposes some other space as the condition of its limitation, and so on. As regards limitation, therefore, our procedure in space is also a regressus, and the transcendental idea of the absolute totality of the synthesis in a series of conditions applies to space also, and I am entitled to demand the absolute totality of the phenomenal synthesis in space as well as in time. Whether my demand can be satisfied is a question to be answered in the sequel. Secondly, the real in space, that is, matter, is conditioned. Its internal conditions are its parts, and the parts of parts its remote conditions. So that in this case we find a regressive synthesis, the absolute totality of which is a demand of reason. But this cannot be obtained otherwise than by a complete division of parts, whereby the real in matter becomes either nothing or that which is not matter, that is to say, the simple. Consequently, we find here also a series of conditions and a progress to be unconditioned. Thirdly, as regards the categories of a real relation between phenomena, the category of substance and its accidents is not suitable for the formation of a transcendental idea. That is to say, reason has no ground in regard to it to proceed regressively with conditions. For accidents, insofar as they inhere in a substance, are coordinated with each other, and do not constitute a series. And, in relation to substance, they are not properly subordinated to it, but are the mode of existence of the substance itself. The conception of the substantial might nevertheless seem to be an idea of the transcendental reason. But, as this signifies nothing more than the conception of an object in general, which subsists insofar as we cogitate in it merely a transcendental subject without any predicates, and as the question here is of an unconditioned in the series of phenomena, it is clear that the substantial can form no member thereof. The same holds good of substances in community which are mere aggregates and do not form a series. For they are not subordinated to each other as conditions of the possibility of each other, which, however, may be affirmed of spaces, the limits of which are never determined in themselves, but always by some other space. It is, therefore, only in the category of causality that we can find a series of causes to a given effect, and in which we ascend from the latter as the conditioned to the former as the conditions, and thus answer the question of reason. Fourthly, the conceptions of the possible, the actual, and the necessary do not conduct us to any series, excepting only in so far as the contingent in existence must always be regarded as conditioned, and as indicating, according to a law of the understanding, a condition under which it is necessary to rise to a higher, till, in the totality of the series, reason arrives at unconditioned necessity. There are, accordingly, only four cosmological ideas, corresponding with the four titles of the categories. For we can select only such as necessarily furnish us with a series in the synthesis of the manifold. 1. The absolute completeness of the composition of the given totality of all phenomena. 2. The absolute completeness of the division of given totality in a phenomenon. 3. The absolute completeness of the origination of a phenomenon. 4. The absolute completeness of the dependence of the existence of what is changeable in a phenomenon. We must here remark, in the first place, that the idea of absolute totality relates to nothing but the exposition of phenomena, and therefore not to the pure conception of a totality of things. Phenomena are here, therefore, regarded as given, and reason requires the absolute completeness of the conditions of their possibility, in so far as these conditions constitute a series, consequently and absolutely, that is, in every respect, complete synthesis, whereby a phenomenon can be explained according to the laws of the understanding. Secondly, it is properly the unconditioned alone that reason seeks in this serially and regressively conducted synthesis of conditions. It wishes, to speak in another way, to attain to completeness in the series of premises so as to render it unnecessary to presuppose others. This unconditioned is always contained in the absolute totality of the series when we endeavour to form a representation of it in thought. But this absolutely complete synthesis is itself but an idea, for it is impossible, at least beforehand, to know whether any such synthesis is possible in the case of phenomena. When we represent all existence in thought by means of pure conceptions of the understanding, without any conditions of sensuous intuition, we may say with justice that for a given conditioned, the whole series of conditions subordinated to each other is also given. For the former is only given through the latter. But we find in the case of phenomena a particular limitation of the mode in which conditions are given, that is, through the successive synthesis of the manifold of intuition, which must be complete in the regress. Now, whether this completeness is sensuously possible is a problem, but the idea of it lies in the reason, be it possible or impossible to connect with the idea adequate empirical conceptions. Therefore, as in the absolute totality of the regressive synthesis of the manifold in a phenomenon, following the guidance of the categories which represent it as a series of conditions to a given conditioned, the unconditioned is necessarily contained, it being still left unascertained whether and how this totality exists. Reason